Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This week, I'm joined by the Irish actress, best known for playing Claire Devlin in Dairy Girls, Nicola Coughlan. Through the power of technology, Nicola and I recorded this episode from our respective homes in different countries last week and discovered that there were a lot of similarities between our experiences of moving to London with big dreams and the reality of feeling really lonely. One of the things that I love about Nicola is her honesty. She talks about getting a lot of knockbacks in the industry and why she was actually working at an optician's and living at her parents' house when an open call audition gave her her big break. As ever, we talk about the podcast Nicola loves, including Getting Curious with Jonathan Van Ness, JVN, you know, being one of her BFFs, and The Mystery Show, which made me think of my own mystery, my missing matching socks. Anyone else find that their matching socks always disappear? Enough from me. I hope you all enjoy today's show with the lovely Nicola Coughlan. Nicola Coughlan, welcome to Castaway.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for giving me something to do.
Thank you for giving me something to do. Where are you? I was trying to think when I first met you, and I can't really remember the first time I properly met you. I just feel like I've known you always, even though I think I've probably met you three times.
I know, but yeah, when you just said that there, I was like, God, I have no idea, but it just feels like I've known you for a really long time. I don't know. Maybe it was at the Irish Embassy. For anyone who doesn't know, the Irish Embassy do these like lovely Irish nights, as they would do. And you sort of have all these Irish people together in the room. And my English friends do sometimes make fun and they go, how do you know that person? It's just because they're Irish. And I'm like, no. And then think, oh, kind of, yeah.
What I love about you is you've got so many different parts to you. There's so many things that you even say yourself, like you love drama, you love theatre, you're on stage at the Old Vic, but you also, you love watching Love Island. My show After Sun, and you love Drag Race.
And I love TV. I think it's true. I think we are in a golden age of television. And I think, thank God, because we need it right now. But I love all different types of things. Yeah, like love Island, obsessed with Drag Race. This current season is a really good one, actually, thank God.
When you came on Your Son this year, we went to the green room afterwards for a few drinks.
Oh God, yeah, you can.
And normally you stay for an extra half an hour after the show, just as a little wind down. And I just remember we sat in a corner on a sofa and started talking and started pouring the wine or whatever it was we were drinking. And next time I looked around, no one else was there but one poor runner who wanted to probably go home.
God, I love
that. And it was about 1 a.m. later, 2 a.m.
I know, it was so nice because my filming schedule in January and February was very full on. I was in pretty much every day. There was one stage I did like 14 days in a row. In fact, that might have been in the middle of it, I think. And yeah. I hadn't been able to socialize. So that night was like such a release. It was so much fun. I didn't want to go home. We just kept nattering away. But yeah, we did end up staying much longer than we should have.
Well, I was very happy to be your drinking buddy that night.
Me too.
It was the first time I kind of got to properly talk to you about other things and not just in passing. And everyone knows you from Dairy Girls as Claire. That was we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Yes.
But you're actually from Galway, which is the west of Ireland. For people who don't know the west of Ireland, tell us exactly where you're from.
So I'm from Galway, right on the Atlantic. So lots and lots of rain is what I always tell people. Very beautiful, very green, but you're going to have to be prepared for rain if you come here. That's when, like, living in London, people complain about the weather. I'm like, you have no idea. You have no idea what it's like. It was lovely. I'm the youngest of four children. My dad was in the army and my mom was a stay-at-home mom. And I was the typical youngest child that was just, you know, a bit, I don't know, I guess a bit of a space cadet. I was super into like movies and TV when I was little. I kind of went and did my own thing a little bit. And I used to like rewatch The Wizard of Oz all the time. And I had my own camcorder. So made my own home movies. And
I did that as well.
Did you?
Oh, I thought I was the only one. I used to make commercials. I used to make like Daz commercials and like be Shane Ritchie and stuff. And then put like stains on my...
my uncle's clothes and me and my cousin used to make videos. Oh God.
Yeah, I used to do the same. I used to do ones where I was like different sportscasters, and I used to love infomercials. So I used to make lots of infomercials and wrote my friends in and stuff. So it was pretty good preparation, spending lots of time on my own doing.
Well, this is the thing. We might have to. So you kind of grew up in this household, and where did the acting bug come from?
I think my sister Clodagh, she's 8 years older than me, and I saw her in a school play when I was about 5 or 6. And so she was in the secondary school, and when you were in the primary school, you'd get to go and watch like a matinee performance of their musical. So they were doing, was it Calamity Jane, I think?
And Doris Day.
Yeah, but I was like, this is the big biz. This is amazing. So this is like a story that my mum always tells, that I knew I was going to this. So I wanted to get something very fancy to wear. So I was six. So I went into her wardrobe and got like this black spangly waistcoat covered in sequins. Then I wore that over like my flowery jumper. And my sister was probably about 14 at the time and looked down in the audience and saw this little baby Liza Minnelli like waving at her. And I think I saw her in that and was like, oh yeah, I'll do this as a job. I like this.
Now, the thing about knowing what you want to do and then actually doing it are two very different things.
Yes.
And there's a lot of people, when they're younger, they say, I want to be on TV, or I want to act, and I want to do this. But to actually stick out in an industry, that's very tough, and people forget how tough. How do you get yourself into the room?
I always knew deep down it's what I wanted to do, but I didn't come from an acting background. I didn't know any actors growing up. You know, I think it's a real shame in Ireland that we don't teach drama in schools, not just for people who want to get into acting, but just for kids in general, to help with their confidence and, you know, public speaking and lots of different things. One of my drama teachers, Claire Power, acted as my agent from when I was about 14. She sent a lot of us to this voiceover open call. And I've always loved accents. I've always been really fascinated by them. So I got hired by this company to do voiceovers for cartoons. So I used to voice like all the little princesses and mice and whatever.
Princesses and mice.
Yeah, it's my specialty. Everyone's
great
got a niche.
Talking about podcasts, which is a great way of storytelling, you did one called Duvet Days, which is a BBC show, which you actually recorded from. Is that the bedroom you're in now? Did you record that one?
Yes, so this is
there?
My second podcast from this bed. Hello, agent got an email and she rang me. She said, the BBC want to come and interview. And I went, oh, that's cool. And they went, in your bed. And I went, well, what? And I think I was like between jobs at the time. So, you know, it's very expensive to live in London. So if I'm not working, I generally don't stay there. So I was like, oh, I'm at home, like me and my mom and stuff. And she's like, no, it's fine. So yeah, Abby Hollick, this lady, came and interviewed me in my bed. And it was lovely. It was really sweet. And you sort of just sit in and just chat away. And it was lovely.
It's actually great because she's had everyone from like Christine and the Queens to yourself, Monroe Bergdorf. And I've never talked about this podcast before. I know about it. But I always think when you get people in a different place, you get so much more out of them. I've talked about Jessie Ware before, and you know, she talks with her mother as she's cooking a meal with somebody. How did you feel? Did you feel a little bit more open when you're in your own bed, a bit more comfortable to reveal more?
Nervous at the beginning because I was like, it's such a strange setup. And
wait, what were you wearing? Like pajamas?
Oh no, I think I wore dungarees.
Okay.
I had dungarees. No, I didn't want to commit whole hog. Although my mum thought it was quite cool to have the BBC, you know, at your house and stuff. And I wore dungarees and we said, it took me a while, but then you do just start opening up. And it's fun because, I mean, in this room, as I said, it's my childhood bedroom. So there's so many little things around that you could kind of talk about. I mean, I have posters from plays I did long, long ago and pictures. And
my bedroom at home hasn't changed and my mom still has it the exact same way. It's like a shrine to me,
yeah,
pretty much. Has there ever been, you know, talk about updating the bedroom from your childhood?
I think at one point I did, like, I was probably about 21, like just finishing college, and I was like, I'm going to update it and make it all cool and slick. And then I'm really glad I never did, because it's like got doll wallpaper, it's got all the old teddy bears in the corner. But you know, I have like my grown-up flat in London that's all, you know, fancy, and I got all my fancy glasses and stuff. And then I come back here, it's quite nice to come back to that old space. I think it's really comforting, and I know not everybody has that, so I'm lucky. I remember taking my wardrobe doors down when I was about 15 and painting them bright pink, and they're still bright pink. And but no, it's nice. It's comforting.
Love that. And I want to go back for when you left, because you live in London now, but you're back home at the moment.
Yes.
When did you first move to London?
Oh, gosh. When I first moved to the UK in 2008, which I felt so alone. Well, I was in Oxford initially, is where I went to drama school first off. And I was like the only Irish person at drama school. And I loved that. But I moved to London first in 2011. And I had the worst time. I had a terrible time. And I always think it's like important to tell people that, because I think you think about, I'm probably same as yourself, going to a big city and like, I'm going to live my dreams. I'm going to do all this. And then it like doesn't happen that way. And it's really disconcerting and you're broke and, you know, it's hard. But it was 2011 was my first time in London. Definitely not a success.
When you went over to study, how difficult is it to get into drama college?
Oh, it's so hard. I had done university first. I'd done 3 years in Galway and then a year studying abroad in Malta.
Malta?
Yeah, I lived in Malta for a year.
What's Malta like?
Amazing. I had like the best time of my life there. I loved it so much. I was like in this place with all the other international students. I was like 19 and we just had a ball. And I hadn't lived away from home for my first bit of college. So, you know, probably couldn't go as mad as I wanted to. And then I went there and it was just like, you know, lived with a girl from Russia, two from America, one from Spain, one from Belgium, one from France. Like, it was so amazing to me. And yeah, I was there for the whole year. Did no studying. It was terribly badly behaved. But yeah, amazing. Loved it.
So did you have to audition for Oxford?
Yes. So yeah, I was just finishing up my degree. And then it's like, this is really what I want to do. But it's hard to admit that, I think. You know, when you don't know anyone else doing it, you're not like, oh, well, so-and-so did this, so maybe I could do it. I didn't really have that. And I was going, oh, what's everyone going to think if I turn around and go, I really want to be an actor? Are they going to laugh at me? Even though I had done jobs and stuff that, you know, it was starting in a whole new country. And I always felt like the drama schools in the UK were longer established. So that's where I wanted to go. But it was scary. So I left it on the long finger, and then by the time I kind of plucked up the courage to apply, I think there was only two schools left taking applications. So one was Lambda and the other was Oxford School of Drama. And I'd heard of Lambda before, but never Oxford. And then I saved up the money to go to the Lambda audition and just bombed it. So I remember doing a speech from A Midsummer Night's Dream. I was doing Helena, I think, who was the tall one, and I should have been doing Hermia, who's like the little one. Just, you know, it was a bad decision. And I sat down on the floor and blanked. It went out.
Forgot your words.
They went out of my head. It was just gone. And then I just looked at them and they were like, very kindly, were like, would you like to start again? And I was like, yes, please. Started again, sat down on the floor, blanked at the exact same point. And then was so upset because I was in London on my own. I didn't know a soul. And I remember the thing I did to cheer myself up, instead of like, I don't know what normal people would do, go get an ice cream, I went to see Platform 9 3/4 in King's Cross.
Harry Potter.
Yeah, I was like, that'll make me feel better.
Did it?
Somewhat. Yeah, I had to ask a tourist to take a picture of me with the trolley because like I didn't have any friends. So I did that. But then I'd really screwed that up. And then Oxford was like a few weeks after that. And I went and I think I kind of screwed that one up as well. It was for their 3-year course. And I was like, okay, I don't know what I'm going to do now because I've screwed both of those up. And then got a call from Oxford a few weeks later that were like, we would like you to do our foundation course if you're interested, which was not like the 3-year. It was like a 6-month and I was jumped at the chance. I was so happy. So it's so competitive because even after Oxford, I finished that foundation course and thought I was like, I've got this. I know what to do. And I didn't get back into a course at drama school and I was like devastated. I think back now and I'm like, yeah, I think I did really boring auditions that year because I came out and I was like, the key is doing nothing, which is, you know, surprisingly not the thing. But I think applying to drama school, like I used to have, you know, these lists drawn out of like, okay, these people went here and if you do a speech at this place, you should do this kind of thing. And you try and like guess the system. And it's a tough thing because I think an audition for a role, it's like, are you right for this part? Whereas with drama school, it's like, are you good in general? And to get a no from that is like really crippling. You're like, oh my God. Especially after having been at drama school and gotten some training to then go back and not get in. You're like, how bad must I be? This,
and you
like,
think of those people like Kerry Mulligan and George Mackay that never went to drama school and who are amazing.
So it's just a different, acting is a different path for everybody. There's no one way to kind of to do it.
You said when you were thinking about this is what I want to do for the rest of my life, you were wondering what would people think? What did people think? What did your family think when the youngest baby in the family went off to Oxford.
I mean, I think I was quite embarrassed about it in a way. And I think my dad, you know, having been in the army his whole life since he was like 19, I think he just thought, what the hell? I mean, they'd always known, obviously, that I'd been really into it and that, you know, I'd worked somewhat. But I think to then go to rely on it as your career is a bit terrifying, because it's realistically, a lot of people, they never make a living out of it, which is really crap, but it's just the way things are.
I think people will be shocked by that, because from the outside, you're an overnight success.
It's hilarious because I'm so not. And I always think we should try and dispel that myth for people, because I think it's so easy to fixate on that. But I think, I don't know how good being an overnight success is, because I know we've certainly talked about it and how sometimes when success comes on people too suddenly, they don't deal with it well.
You know, in a big break, which I didn't know about until I heard you mention it in a podcast, was the open audition going for the Vic, which you kind of had to do it yourself. And I think people sometimes are waiting for the call. The call doesn't always come to you. Make it happen.
No, I mean that there was a million things that I tried to get that I didn't. To be extremely front-footed. But it's funny, I think it's such a classic story, because I've seen it happen to friends too. At the point that you go, maybe this isn't working out, I might give up. I feel like if it's meant to happen, something will pop up. I left London because I couldn't afford it anymore. I was living back at home. I felt like a big failure, honestly. And I was working in an optician's 2 days a week. And I was on the bus coming home and saw a tweet from the Old Vic that were like, we're having an open call for the Old Vic New Voices Festival. And I knew how rare that was. So I was like, okay, I'm going to apply for this. And I was like, I'll figure out the details later. Like, I didn't have very much money, so I knew it was going to be an expense for me to go to London. But I was like, I'm just going to do this. So I got my mum to pick me up from the bus, drive me home. I went on the like family PC, like applied, got a spot. And they were gone within hours, because open auditions just like don't happen. And then after I'd applied, I went, what am I doing? Like, this is dumb. I've had auditions, I haven't gotten them. Why am I putting all my hopes and dreams into this? And I thought, okay, look, just do it. Stop overthinking it. And then when I got to London to do it, it was a panel of about 12 people, I think, and about 30 actors, and everyone auditioned in front of everyone else.
Oh, was that intimidating?
It was, but I think...
Or did it give you a bit of a drive?
I think it gave me a bit. I think, at that point, because I was like, I've got nothing to lose. Like, I decided to do a monologue from a play that I've been in called Chapel Street, written by my friend Luke Barnes. And I was like, I'm just going to do something short, snappy and funny. And because I didn't know what I was auditioning for.
How do you audition for something if you don't know what the role is?
But I mean, maybe that was freeing. I don't know, because I wasn't trying to fit into anything. I was like, I'm just going to do this. And it's and then a few weeks later, I got a call to be like, OK, you've been shortlisted. And I was like, whoa, OK, amazing. And then I went in to read for, I didn't know what the play was. And it turned out to be this play called Jess and Joe Forever, which turned out to be one of the most beautiful things I've ever, ever read and still have ever read. It's if anyone wants to get it, like, you get the script on Amazon, and it's just a beautiful read. It's a love story about this young boy and young girl who meet when they're like 9 years old. And it's about every summer they meet in Norfolk growing up. And she's very posh. Also the character was very posh and from London. So they rang me when I got the recall, and they were like, by the way, she's got a really English accent, this character. So if you can't do it, we don't want. I went, no, I can do it. I can do it. I was like, I'll nail it. I'll get this. So I went to read for them, and then, got the role, which was amazing.
It's I'm just listening to your story. I just feel so many parallels to my life, because my first big job was the MTV presenting, and I entered a competition. It was an open casting, and I was living in Ireland. And I had no money, had to kind of get myself over there to audition. And again, we were all auditioning in front of each other. And it's so interesting to listen to you talk about that, because it was one of those things where I'm like, I have no idea how to get into this industry. My family don't come from this. Everything I saw that open audition, I went, feck it. Because if you're not in it, you can't get it. And people aren't going to knock on my door. I have to knock on theirs.
But I remember when you got that, like, not knowing you at all, but it's always when an Irish person does well, we were like, oh my god, this girl from Bray is the new MTV presenter. But it's just like, it's like so exciting when you see an Irish person do well, you're like, oh my god, brilliant.
And just and even you saying 2008 when you first went to the UK, I remember just feeling really lonely at 2008 coming over here and not knowing anybody, and
oh god,
people at home were like, oh, you've got this great lifestyle, you're off doing this. And probably similar to now, even when you're filming, you know, you feel finished filming Bridgerton, and when you're doing Dairy Girls, people don't realize how long those days are and how unglamorous.
Yeah, like life for an example, on Bridgerton, as I said, I did a 14-day stint. Like that's every single day. Then you could get picked up at home. I mean, 4:30 in the morning. And then you get in, it's about 2.5 hours, hair, makeup, costume. And then you film till about 6 p.m. Then you get de-rigged. So you don't get home till like 8 p.m. and you go to bed.
I asked you during the week to send me over just some different podcasts that you've been listening to, because I always find it really interesting what variety of things. And I'm still amazed by every time I ask people to do this podcast that I'm getting new podcasts all the time that I haven't even heard of. And I want to talk about one because I listened to me and Ian actually listened to one this morning and we loved it. Mystery Show. I'd never heard of this podcast before.
Isn't it so good?
And there's only 6 episodes. It was hosted by a girl called Starlee, started in 2015. And tell me a little bit about what it is.
So Mystery Show, it's unlike any other podcast you'll ever listen to. There's only that one series of it, really, sadly. I think they tried to do another one and it didn't work. But this girl called Starlee Kine, people send her in these mysteries of things they can't solve. Like one is that someone found a belt buckle in a bush.
So they're not your average, because I've listened to a lot of like The Perfect Murder and The Last Days of August and all these like big mysteries of what happened or who did it. While these are more smaller mysteries in everyday life.
Yeah, they're just like things that are not Googleable, and you can kind of, and they always end up opening up these crazy backstory. So the belt buckle one, it was like this belt buckle that had a toaster on it that you clicked it and up came a piece of toast, and they were like, we want to find out whose belt this was. And then another one was about Jake Gyllenhaal's height. Was that the first one? Did you listen to that one?
What's the Jake Gyllenhaal one?
She couldn't find out what his real height was because every website listed a different height. So she went on this like big mission to find out what height he was. And it's just so charming and it's so different. And they have another one where this author had seen a paparazzi photo of Britney Spears from like years ago where she was holding a copy of her book, but she's not a well-known author and not like, you know, she was like, how the hell did Britney Spears get my book? I don't know what the connection is. So they investigated that. But it's just something really charming and comforting about it. It's so good.
It kind of goes back to the human mind and the curiosity of the human mind to get to the bottom of something. Even the things at the very beginning of the show, they say, find out why he never called you back. Do you know that guy that never called you back? Yeah. Was it me or was it him?
Yeah.
The one I listened to was about the video store. So it was this girl who had... Remember video stores back in the day, if you're old enough to remember them, the Blockbusters and all that. And she had rented a video, and then, you know, you pay whatever it is overnight. She went to return it the next day and the video shop was gone. Just gone. Just disappeared completely. The building was there, but it was, and she was like, what happened to that video shop? And there's such little stories, but they're just how, I think it's how she tells the stories as well. You just get hooked.
Here's what I think is weird about the whole thing.
Okay.
The store did not look like it was going to be gone. There were other people there. There were movies on all the shelves.
The way Laura tells it, the next night, it was as though the video store never existed. The building itself was still there, but the windows were covered with brown craft paper. And behind them, Laura could see that the inside of the store had been completely emptied out. Even the shelving units were gone. What had been a thriving business had overnight become a shuttered storefront. I asked Laura if she had any relevant clues.
I remember the woman who helped me had a mustache, a very strong mustache.
In a way that was working or wasn't working?
It's very rare that I think that it works on a lady. Mm-hmm. Frida Kahlo rocked it. You know, Brezhnev's wife, I seem to recall having a mustache. But usually I think it's a tough call.
Mm-hmm. So the mustache girl said nothing?
Nothing. I filled out a card to rent. I became a member.
The day before it closed.
The day before it closed, and she didn't say anything like, why don't you write this in pencil? Just do it right in the air, sign a signature in the air.
And how do you know it was the next day?
Because I remember what movie it was, and I can remember and tell you why I returned it the next day.
Go for it.
Must Love Dogs.
Oh.
I rented Must Love Dogs. And the reason I know that that's the movie is because I now own Must Love Dogs. And I did not love dogs. I must love dogs.
And you don't return movies late?
No, never.
Because see, if I was telling the story, it could have been a year later.
Oh, no. That is so against my nature.
And did they ever call you or contact you or send you a letter?
They didn't say, we've shut our doors. The bank would like to know what happened to Must Love Doc. Do you have it, Laura? And can you believe that Christopher Plummer asked his daughter out on a date? Did you get creeped out by that?
She's such a brilliant storyteller. Like, I feel like if there was any time for that podcast to come back, it would be now. I'm like, we need stuff like that right now. That would be great.
Do you know what I want to know? Where are all my left socks go?
Oh my God, stop. Like,
I do that earlier on. I have all these little jobs around the house because I'm in the house all the time. And yes. One was to match my socks. And I was like, finally, I'm going to do this. It took the coronavirus to finally get me to match my socks. None of them match. Where are they?
No, it's completely bizarre. I have the same thing. I was like, no one else is in this flat. Who else could it be? It has to be me, but I didn't do it. I don't know what's going on.
I love it. But the mystery show, there is only 6 episodes.
Yes.
Have a little listen. Really heartwarming. Feel good.
Definitely. Yeah. There's nothing else really like it. So I feel like it just takes the kind of little mundane things in life and just makes it into this big epic story. And there's something really nice about it.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Where do you normally listen to podcasts?
Oh gosh, I mean, on planes and things like that are really good. I mean, I always have to be entertained because I end up flying over, you know, to and from Ireland quite a bit to see my family. So I need something to entertain me always on those. I don't know how people on a plane can just sit there, even for an hour. I'm like, no, God, I need constant simulation.
I love your Instagram because I feel I get a real insight into you. I know you put a lot of glamorous things up and you on red carpets, but even when you were filming Bridgerton, the amount of time that you have to spend just sitting in a trailer.
When the show comes out, you'll be able to see we've got the most incredible lavish costumes. I've got this epic wig. We're filming in the most beautiful locations, but we are not allowed to share anything. It's like very, very, very top secret right now. So, you know, I'd say to Netflix, can I take a picture of this glove and post it? They'd be like, absolutely not, nothing. Because it's going to be epic when it launches. It will be worth it. But Bridgerton is based on a book series by this author called Julia Quinn. And the books are huge in Brazil. The minute the cast got announced, there was fan accounts set up for all of us in Brazil. And they send the most like lovely supportive comments. But they're dying for any Bridgerton related content. But I'm very limited in what I can share right now. So I try and be inventive. But a lot of it is just me sat in a trailer on my own, to be honest.
Yeah, I was thinking, I'm like, God, that poor girl.
Yeah.
You're a podcast to listen to. We were talking about the mystery show and just suppose human nature and the curiosity we have. Another podcast, which I'm a big fan of, and we did talk about on the show before, was Getting Curious with John Jones.
Yes.
Your soul sister. How are you? I went to your birthday party, which was great fun, by the way.
Thank you very much. It was like the last party of the century. I'm like, oh my God, did we do anything after that?
Thank God we had that party because it's going to be a while.
It's going to have to keep us going for a while.
I love Getting Curious because, Jonathan, he talks to everybody, including yourself, but he talks to everyone. He had Senator Elizabeth Warren on. Just had such a mixture of people, which I love. And I love just because as humans, like you, you're interested in so many different things. There's so many different aspects. But what I want to know is how did Nicola Coughlan become friends with Jonathan Finnis? And why was he at her birthday party?
Okay, so it's a hilariously ridiculous story. So I was filming a show called Harlots at the time that Queer Eye came out. And I was like, oh my God, the world needs this show right now. It is such a tonic. But I always wear very comfy clothes because you're, you know, especially shooting period drama, you're in a corset all day. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, I want the comfiest jumper possible to like sit and get my hair and makeup done in. And then I was like, oh, if I had a jumper with that Jonathan's face, like that would make me happy. because like they're just such a joyous person. But then I went out.
That's like, completely normal, Nicola.
Just the way my brain works, I guess. But I went online, and because the show was only brand new, there was nothing. So I was like, oh, what am I going to do? So I just made one. And I was like, oh, amazing. And then it came and I was like, oh, so happy about it. And then I put it on Instagram and I was like, oh, I wanted the perfect jumper, but it didn't exist. So I got this made. And then Jonathan saw it. And what I found out from their side was that Jonathan was still like hairdressing pretty much full time in LA when the show had come out, and they didn't really know if it was going to take off still, and saw my video. And this was someone that they didn't know, the other side of the world, that like loved the show and had their face on a jumper and like started bawling crying, and then sent me a message of them crying and be like, oh my god, girl, I love you. And I was like, what? I love you? What is what's happening here? And then we just started just speaking over Instagram and messaging one another, and then Johnny watched Dairy Girls, and then I was going to go to New York for my birthday in 2019, and then I was like, I'm coming to New York if you want it. Like, do you want to hang out? So we did, and just like really hit it off. And then, yeah, like if anyone's wondering what Jonathan is like as special as on Queer Eye, but actually way more, like just a magical, wonderful person. And Jonathan's podcast is so incredible because Jonathan is such a curious person and they're so interested in people. And I think that's so key.
And so important as well with his audience. He gets people looking at social issues differently. There was one, how can we twerk on climate change, with Bill Nye, the science guy.
Yeah.
And it just gives you a fresh outlook, because I think a lot of people, there's so much information out there, there's so much news, and it's trying to get it in a digestible, fun format, which he does.
Completely.
If you're passionate about
climate change.
Yeah, but no, but equality, that's what I'm trying to say. Climate change has a relationship to every other issue that is important to us, and people don't see that. So what I'm begging you to do,
Bill,
this whole time
Nye.
Is paint the fucking picture to people on why they should give a fuck.
Oh, yeah.
Why does climate change, why is it so important to us right here? Why is it an economic issue? Why is it an equality issue?
So if we didn't need to buy oil from overseas, then the threat of terrorism to our oil supply would just not be that significant. And that would be true not just for the U.S., but for any country or large area with a group of countries. This would seem like common sense. And then
so you're saying our dependence on oil from countries that are rich in oil from the Middle East starts to create some of the imbalance in the first place.
Oh, yeah. And then wait, there's more. So because the because of desertification, because deserts are getting bigger in the Middle East, land is drying out, young people are leaving the family farms and going to the big city looking for work. And this is where, apparently, to a large extent, you get young people, young men, who are disenchanted and get recruited by terrorist organizations. Like that, even that is connected to climate change. And then the terrorist organizations that take over these dams that are used for irrigation, for raising farm food in those areas. This is all related to having weather patterns change. So for us in the scientifically literate side of this, climate change's tentacles reach every facet. Now, when you talk about equality, if we had more equality worldwide, let alone in your own county, wherever you live, there's just less conflict. When people have enough, they don't get at each other's throats.
I always really respect people that are, you know, they're smart but not condescending and can make it accessible and fun. I think Jonathan and John Ronson, who's someone I so admire.
Oh, I love John Ronson.
Yeah, they both do that so well, where it's like super smart but accessible, fun and funny. And I think that's really important. It does make you tell when people are interested in stuff. And they are like really care about it. They'll make you care about it. I always think
John Ronson's podcasts are really good for any. We've talked about it before.
So good,
really good. Something to do when you're at home at the moment.
Yes,
I want to talk about Call Chelsea Peretti, and there's one particular one which is Rain's Coming In. Now, for those who mightn't recognise the name Chelsea Peretti, you'll know who she is because it's Gina from Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Yes. Okay, I am obsessed with this. My friend Camilla, one of my best friends, introduced me to this. So Chelsea Peretti does this podcast whenever she feels like it, which I absolutely love. You could tell she's just completely being herself. And I really enjoy that with people when they're not, you know, like, oh, it's not like really managed and glossy. Like, she, at the minute, she's just posting all these dinners that she's making for her kid. And then, like, her tweets are hilarious. But she, yeah, she is just inherently so funny. Like, I adore her. But this podcast that she does, this particular one, she's written this play called Rain's Coming In. And it's like set in like, you know, this like little town in America. And then there's this one daughter who's gone off to New York and she's come back with a fancy Nespresso machine. And it's got Kate Berlant and John Early in it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know who they are, you should watch Search Party, which is one of the best shows ever. I think
it's also a perfect time now to listen to, because with theatres unfortunately being postponed and shows being postponed, I do miss just going, having that live feel of going somewhere and they have a live audience. So you kind of feel you're at this show, you're in the theatre.
Completely. Like, and I think it does something really well, which I like. Like, it pokes fun at theatre as well, which I think theatre needs sometimes, you know, because it can take itself very seriously. And then this totally flips that on its head. So it's, yeah, it's very funny. It's very good.
Well, let me help you with the door now. It's starting to rain here. Really big out there. Big old drops the size of gumballs.
Terry Ann, oh my goodness, you look incredible.
My first child, come in here, sit down beside me. Let someone get you a water. Well, put your bags down, Terry Ann. Cat got your tongue, talk to us. How's New York City? How's advertising?
What do city folk act like? Why you been gone so long? You don't think you're better than us now, do you?
No, not better, just different.
Oh? Different like how? Like, how do you mean, Terry Ann? Like, in a good way or a bad way? What's different?
Yeah, how do you mean, Terry Ann?
Oh, I don't know. Y'all are putting me on the spot, Lord. I've been traveling all day, and I'm not ready to make a speech. Okay. I do enough of that in my advertising company. I need to lay down a minute and put a hot washcloth on my face for a good solid 20 minutes. Take some of this rain chill out of me. Hey, I bought y'all an espresso machine.
She pulls a small Nespresso machine out of her bag.
Ah, plug it in, Mama. Can she plug it in?
I don't see why not.
All right, I'm really pleased that I've lasted this long without talking about Dairy Girls, because now I'm going to, and now I was like, I'm going to hold out. There's other things I need to talk about, but we got to talk about Dairy Girls.
Yes.
And landing that role, because everything you did up to there, and you spent years kind of creating that path and had knockbacks and back and forth and back and forth. And then suddenly, I think when you probably got the role, didn't even realize how big the show was going to be.
Oh God, no, you can't. I mean, you always hope and dream and, you know, do that thing where you're like, I'm being interviewed on The Late Late Show in my brain talking about, oh, what a surprise the show is. But you, I mean, I think there's a very, you really don't think that's going to actually happen.
I love that you mentioned The Late Late Show, because we had Niall Horan on the podcast recently.
And yeah.
He hosted SNL, like Saturday Night Live, huge show over in America. But it was when he did The Late Late Show that his parents recognized how far he'd come.
100%. Yeah. It's funny because I brought my mum and my sister, because we did the five of us Dairy Girls, we did The Late Late together. So and my mum was like, oh, well, I have to sit in the front row. And I was like, I will put in a request. She was like, oh, I can't walk up all the steps. And I was like, yeah, right. You just want to be like right up there. Yeah, it's a big
position.
I was doing Jess and Joe, the play that I'd gotten with the Old Vic. It had been like a year afterwards. We did a very, we did a one-off performance at the Old Vic, and then I got taken on to another theatre called The Orange Tree. And when this is all over, I would really like to encourage people to go to there. It's in Richmond in London, and they have the most excellent programming of like a lot of theatres in London. Paul Miller, who runs it, he's got a lot of, supports a lot of new writers and stuff, and also does a lot of classic plays. But yeah, please do support them when all of this craziness is over, because they deserve it. But yeah, I was doing that show at the time, and then I just signed with my agent, because I also, I had always wanted to be with Curtis Brown, this agency, because I loved their actors. I was like, I just feel like they're doing the work I would love to be doing, and I really love the way they've helped them shape their careers and stuff. And then I invited like a billion agents to come and see Jess and Joe Forever, the play, and only one came, and they were from Curtis Brown. And yeah, it's funny the way, you know, things work out. But I mean, there was about 60 agents that didn't come. But yeah, the one I wanted to do.
All you need is one.
All you need is one person to say yes. But yes, my first audition, it just so happened with my agent was Dairy Girls. I remember getting the script through and it was like not like anything I'd ever read before. I'd never seen young women written that way and kind of allowed to be grotesque and over the top funny. And it just felt real. You know, it felt like, though, this is how my friends spoke when we were in school. We were, you know, very obsessed with one another. And it wasn't all about, you know, what boys are we going to go out with and what's this? And
it felt very fresh.
But I had a very strong connection to the script the minute I got it. And that doesn't happen very often. But I was like, I said to my sister, I don't know why, but I feel like I'm going to get this. I really feel it in my bones. And she was like, well, okay, well, then you will. Okay, let's just go with that. And then it was like, it was a 6-month audition process. So I didn't immediately get the role. But in the end, we got
there. So what's involved in that 6 months?
Oh, gosh. So the first scene I got sent was the denim jacket. I'm not being an individual on my own. That was the very first page of Dairy Girls that I ever read. And then the other scene for the audition was with David Donnelly outside the shop, played by Anthony Boyle, who's now in a big HBO show.
He's a great actor.
He is fantastic. He's going to be a megastar. But that was the other scene that was in it. And then I was like, God, this is really good. So I, you know, I read as much as I think I only had those two scenes. So I had to try and like figure out who the character was just from that. But I felt like Lisa's writing was very clear. So I was like, I feel like I know who Claire is and I know who Claire was in my school. And then I had to go and try and learn the accent because it wasn't, I'd never done it before. So as I've said to people many times, I learned it from Nadine Coyle. You know, there was no show from Derry on TV. There was no reference point. So yeah, listening to that. And then I went to meet Carla Strong, the casting director at Hattrick in London, and went and did my first audition and felt like it went well, but you know, you don't know. And then I didn't hear anything for like a month and a half. And then just before Christmas, I remember then going and buying clothes that I thought Claire would wear. So it's funny because I bought like little dungarees and t-shirts and stuff and was like, just had this idea of what she would look like. And so I was like, I want to feel a little bit like maybe she would feel. And then my second audition, I think I met with Carla, the casting director again, Lisa, who created the show, Liz Lewin, our executive producer. I met with them and just, we went through a couple of scenes and then I waited again for ages. And then I think my last audition was a chemistry test. So it was the first time I met the girls.
I met with a lot of shows that come out, it's always like, who's in it? Who's the person? Yeah. Who's the famous face that's in it? Well, you guys were all kind of on that journey together.
Yeah, it's bonded us together and that we all kind of get what it's like. And we're like, Carla. Yeah, it's funny thinking back about that first day that we all met. And I mean, I 100% thought I'd screwed up the last audition.
Well, I'm very happy that you didn't. Looking back and kind of listening to your journey, and it's there's probably different parts where you easily could have given up, and you finally get to that stage where you get the job, you get the big break, and that's what so many actors are looking for, to book the job, get the break. And during that time, when career-wise everything is going so well, you lost your dad in that time, and life just seems shit. Life seems unfair.
I lost him 5 days before I got the part in Dairy Girls. So he sadly, he didn't know I ever got it. It's sad that he never got to see it. And there's, I mean, I'm so privileged and I'm so lucky and I have a really special life. But there's of course so many times that I get, you know, like the first time we were at the BAFTAs and we won all these incredible awards, you know, there's always that tinge of sadness that he's not here to see it. And, you know, there's even silly things like I've got like 3 like little plants in my apartment that I've like been keeping alive. And I'm like, I'd love to just like tell my dad that, you know, he's like really green fingered. He loved it. You know, at the end of the day, what most of us want is just to make our parents really proud. But yeah, it's hard, definitely.
And there'll always be those things that remind you of him, that he's there as well, like you said, the plants in your house and different things he told you on the way, and the support that he gave you to follow your dream and
completely
do, as you said, when you turned around and said, this is what I want to do, that you weren't laughed at.
I'm certain
he's so proud of you. What, Nicola, what is your dream role, or have you had it?
I would love to play Sally Bowles in Cabaret. I love that sort of type of character, and I think like a very good heart but sort of selfish, and I think just interesting women. I would love to play a lot of interesting women if I could.
I think real women as well. I feel in the past a lot of roles are two-dimensional, and it's that real. Like, even listening to your story about how you got into the industry and how hard it is and how things aren't perfect, because sometimes through Disney and growing up, we think everything should work out a certain way and it doesn't.
Completely. And I think
not to have everything polished and perfect, but then I also am like, oh, well, this is boring, I won't share it. But then we don't see a lot of the hard days or the boring days. Like,
we've had some great suggestions of podcasts from you there. And all, if you were to do a podcast, I feel like, what would you do it about?
Oh, so my friend and I have talked about this, but I would love to do the Irish version of Rain's Coming In, like the Chelsea Peretti one. The idea has been floated, it's been talked about, so we'll see. We've lots of time on our hands now, so it might be the perfect time to do it.
And how is everything back in Galway? Because Ireland and the UK are a bit different, because obviously different governments and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, how is everyone back home?
So it's not on full lockdown here, but it's pretty full on. Like, all the schools have been closed for a couple weeks now, and I mean, I haven't seen anyone other than my mom. I don't see my siblings, my nieces and nephews or anything like that. So people are taking it very, very seriously. I'm only trying to go to the shop like once a week and stuff. And
you're lucky because you've had, I suppose, this show, Bridgerton, which will be coming out later in the year. You've already recorded it. But how are a lot of your friends working, like out of work actors or actors who maybe have had shows recently cancelled? How are they doing?
I mean, you know, actors, producers, directors, all of this, we're self-employed people. You know, there's a whole other level of stress that people don't think about. And also, once this stops, we have nothing. We have no income. And I've just come off a job, so I'm lucky that I have a little bit saved up. But I know people in really dire situations, you know. It's going to be really, really hard. So I think we just need to do what we can to support one another. What Alison Spittle is doing is incredible.
Yes.
She has started doing something called the Co-Video Party, where every night at 9 p.m. she puts a movie on Netflix, and then she hosts like dress up competitions, and she live tweets it. And then she's a comedian and has lost all her income, so she is trying to, like, you know, self fund and like pay her rent basically. You can like basically give her the price of a coffee for doing it. So which I think, like, if you really enjoy someone's work, someone like a comedian, a poet, a writer, whatever, and they're trying to, you know, generate stuff to entertain you at this time, if you can donate to them, I would say, you know, please try and do that.
Yeah, thinking about supporting people, Patreon is great as well. There's two podcasts that I love. One is Blind Boys, who's on the first series,
yes,
Rubber Bandits, and another is Jarlath Regan, who's just an Irish man abroad. And I actually subscribe to that. It's free to listen to, but I subscribe to it because if I go to a shop and I buy a magazine, or I download a video on a video, I'm so old school, I download a film online, I have to pay for it. So why shouldn't I pay for that if you do have it? So Patreon is really great for a lot of performers, comedians, artists who normally would get paid from gigs and tickets. I think it's really important to get on Patreon. I know there's a few other ones as well out there, and support them in any way you can. There's another thing for comedians called Heckle the Virus, where you can support comedians, because a lot of people now are putting their work online, on podcasts, on streaming services, on Insta Lives, and not being paid. So if there's any way that we can give back and support them, I think it's really important.
Absolutely, yeah. Massively agree.
I love that. I really loved this.
Me too.
I really needed this chat today, so thank you.
So did I. It's definitely brightened my day up a huge amount.
Thank you so much for all the recommendations there as well of the podcast that you've listened to, and we will put them up as well for people to see. And do think about doing something online. I think I'd love to see a Nicola Coughlan version of Chelsea Peretti show. I'd love that.
I will try. I'll try my best.
Thank you so much. Lots of love back
to
Ireland.
Lots of love.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
And that's it. Another episode down as we delve deep into my guest's audio world. I hope you get cast away by today's top podcast picks. Yeah, I just said that, sorry. All of the podcasts we've mentioned today are included in the episode show notes. Now, if you love this conversation as much as I did, please share your thoughts by leaving a review. And if you'd like to receive weekly installments of Cast Away delivered straight to your phone, hit the subscribe button. Until next time, that's it from me. Take care.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.